Welcome to another Innovation Forum podcast with me, Toby Webb, and I'm delighted to be here in Zurich, in this lovely hotel above the city of Zurich, and I'm here with Hagen Duenbostel, who is CEO of KWS. So welcome to the Innovation Forum podcast, Hagen.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Well, thanks for the invitation to spend a couple of days with you and your colleagues talking about genome editing and sustainable agriculture. So I want to ask you a bit about that, but before I do, why don't you tell our listeners who KWS are? Anyone, I imagine, in the agricultural seeds business who's listening will have heard of you, but a lot of our other listeners may not have done. So just tell us a bit about your company.
Yeah, I bet most of the seed users, they will know us. KWS has a rich tradition and legacy of more than 160 years. A seed company, a plant breeding company founded by family. It's still family owned. And it's covering most, if not all, important field crops, such as corn and cereals and sugar beet and sunflower and rapeseed. So we try to serve farmers in more than 70 countries today with crop rotation and best product, best varieties for the highest yields they can get. And that brings us to number four in the global competitive positioning after the three big competitors who are mostly known because of a consolidation of the industry phase at the moment.
Talking of consolidation, we had a conversation last night where I asked you if I could buy your company, if I had 10 billion euros to offer you now in a giant suitcase, whether or not I could buy your company, and you told me I couldn't. So tell us about why that's the case.
We are in the lucky position that the families are really living up to the legacy, and the families don't talk about money at all. So any price is not something that is considerable. The idea is to create and to maintain a plant breeding company that is looking for being the trusted seed supplier for generations of farmers, which automatically means generations of family owners of the company. So by following that idea, we are completely out of the picture when it comes to acquisitions or even sell the company.
So one of the reasons I asked you about that is because innovation in sustainable agriculture requires significant time scale, significant R&D cash, and listed companies, their CEOs often only get 4 or 5 years. And if they blow a billion, that's it. You know, they're out and the next guy, usually a guy, is in. That's not the case with you guys. So tell us what innovation means for KWS at the moment.
Yeah. KWS balances the business practically from the beginning and time and existence of the company. We try to spend as much as we can in the R&D sector. R&D budgets are growing year after year. But everyone who knows a little bit about plant breeding and variety development knows that creating a new variety is potentially an effort that takes a decade. So the euro spent today actually comes back as revenue in 10 years from now. So in order to have a continuous increase in R&D budgets, it requires a significant growth of the commercial business today. And this is what we do. We basically strive for 5 to maximum 10% in top line growth, which we have seen organically over the many, many years now. And at the same time, we try to at least have profitability levels of double-digit EBIT returns. And keeping it there in the sweet spot allows us to spend as much as affordable into R&D, but also in the expansion of our sales organization globally.
And to the question of innovation, where is that for you? I mean, we've spent the last couple of days discussing genome editing and sustainable agriculture. So is this your main area of innovation at the moment?
Probably most important KPI of innovation is the number of high-performing new varieties every year, because our R&D pipeline, our portfolio, is competing with global competitors for registration of new varieties. They need to be better in at least one characteristic and providing for more yield or better resistance levels. And so the number of new varieties has now increased to about 400 new varieties annually, and it's still growing. So that's the ultimate proof of R&D pipeline and success, applying all technologies available to really fight and compete on the front end when it comes to performance in the field.
Okay. Talking about genome editing specifically, you've convened 40, 50 people here in this lovely hotel for the last couple of days. We've done it under the Chatham House rules. So I'm not going to ask you to break that. But you know, why are we here? Why did you invite me? And what are you taking away from the conversation we've had about genome editing over the last couple of days?
See, plant breeding has started like somewhat 10,000 years ago, and it started off with just a selection of phenotypes. And as we went along all that time, many, many new technologies and methodologies have been available, such as hybrid breeding, such as tissue cultures, many, many things. And with the rising of biotechnology and transgenic events like GM technology is one example of it. Now we are facing a whole bunch of new cluster of technologies, summarized probably under the headline of genome editing technologies. But this is not only just the moment of today. It may be the case, and very likely so, that we see many, many more technologies coming. So we are here now to discuss in that stakeholder community and stakeholder group to promote technology as a tool to end up in high value and value adding products. And we are fighting hard not to exclude any innovation or exclude one of those methods or technologies before we even started to explore and to identify what the benefit for social meaning could be, and to get a grip on that open discussion dialogue is really necessary.
So just explain to our listeners what genome editing is. Let's step back a minute, because I mentioned this to an NGO campaign group and they said, oh yes, CRISPR stuff, that's GM by the back door. And of course, a lot of NGOs associate GM with the Monsanto debacle in Europe of 20 odd years ago, and the fact that GM's not never been accepted in Europe, and you know, it was a terrible communications campaign by the industry, but then, you know, very, very vociferous critics who perhaps didn't always play by the rules meant we ended up with no GM in Europe, for right or wrong. Mm-hmm. Why is genome editing different from genetic modification?
Well, in the end effect, it goes back to evolution, and plants adapt themselves to circumstances and environments they're actually growing. That is something that in nature has led to the survival of the fittest. This is nothing else, evolution is nothing else than mutagenesis. Yeah, so we see differentiation of specific single plants because accidentally they see and undergo a mutagenesis event and adapt themselves to circumstances. So in the past decades, we have worked intensively with mutagenesis methods and technologies in order to synthesize basically or to copy that natural adaptation of plants. Those methods generally require the involvement of chemicals or even radiation in order to make those plants change and adapt. And doing so, the actual specific change is highly unpredictable. So after you have done it, the search begins to select those outcomes, those results that actually fit the needs and accidentally have done a genetic variation that is helping to solve a problem. Now, genome editing, opposed to that, is a very precise punctual mutagenesis or mutation, a targeted mutation. We specifically address a specific spot in the genome and just provoking a change in that specific locus, knowing exactly that at that spot the attractive or the potentially attractive result may be, and so it's much less interference with the genome. It's much more targeted.
So it's the equivalent of using a scalpel rather than a hammer.
In principle, yes. And I guess the confusion arises whenever those methodologies, in principle, are also valid and feasible or capable to do a transfer of genes from outside the species. And that certainly, by definition, would be a GM product, right? So as long as you use targeted mutagenesis methods, within the species, that is primarily nothing else than what I described in classical breeding before. As soon as you transfer genes from outside the species into it, that definitely is GM.
But that's not genome editing.
Well, the technology might be even the same, like CRISPR-Cas. You may use CRISPR-Cas for transfer of genes, and then you're definitely are under a regulation of GM in Europe and in many countries. And that is so important because that illustrates why choosing or judging by technology or process doesn't make any sense, because the differentiation actually comes when you look at the product.
So there are lots of shades of gray, is what I've been hearing.
The cases can be differentiated exactly, so there is not confusion about what is actually in front of you. But the confusion comes because you cannot differentiate the technology, but the result. Yes. I think that's really important, also for regulatory purposes.
Okay. Now, we also had a conversation yesterday about this idea of radical transparency. Companies in different areas of agriculture are starting to use this now in areas like tackling fires, community engagement, land rights, deforestation. What do you think radical transparency could mean for KWS as you try to build your portfolio and products of around genome editing?
Yeah, for us, actually, that is nothing new. If you come to visit our premises at our headquarter, you will find labs behind glass. And we do actually have more than 5,000 visitors per year. So we are having really an open house. And like we here sitting today in an open stakeholder dialogue, there's nothing to hide. It's just the opposite. I think if you want to be on the long term, you want to be successful in plant breeding, you have to really share what is your objective, what kind of intentions do you follow, what kind of technologies do you actually apply, what is the consequences with regard to IP protection. So leaving things out or not telling the entire story or the narrative is deadly, as we have discovered in the past when looking, for instance, of the introduction of GM technologies, and everyone is aware that that we really failed to come up with a social license, a social consensus, and I think that has a lot to do with a lack of radical or full transparency.
And do you see an issue in the future for your company with patents and IP relating to sort of transparency and openness? Because they're often at odds with each other in the science arena, and you know, rightfully so in some cases, in that you know, you've got to have a business model for R&D.
Right. This discussion that we have is not about revisiting so much the existing regulatory framework for GM. Once you accept that there is a specific regulatory purpose and it raises the bar and it costs a lot of money to get a product registered and deregulated, then obviously the financial attractiveness of the result needs to be protected. And this is a good reason to have a pretty solid IP position corresponding to the high level of regulatory that you have to meet. I think we fully understand that. Just opposed to that, if technologies at large extent, because of the safety of the product by nature, do not require high burden on regulatory entrance barriers, obviously the need for IP protection looks a little bit different. And I think the industry needs to be open to discuss that.
Great. Well, thank you, Hagen. We could talk about this all day, as we have been for the last 2 days. But in the interest of time, we'll draw this to a close. Listeners, I hope you found this useful. Have a look at KWS on the web. I think they're an example of an innovative, transparent company who are doing some really interesting work. So worth keeping an eye on. And Hagen, thank you so much for your time.
Thanks, Toby.